Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every big dip in the market brings back raw memories. Is the economy going to tank again? The European meltdown, American debt, the high unemployment rate, these are not classic ingredients for recovery. And yet, until Europe stumbled, even while it's stumbling, there's lots of talk of a U.S. economic comeback. So which is it? This hour On Point, with factory orders up, markets down, and Europe quaking, we'll look at where the American economy may be headed. You can join the conversation. Were you biting your nails this week as the markets slumped, buying gold, afraid of the abyss? Or do you see an economy coming back despite the headlines? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear in a moment from economists Alan Blinder and Carmen Reinhart. And later this hour, a commencement address from husband and wife, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and author Cheryl Wu Dunn, on graduates changing a tough world. But joining me first today from Washington for the latest on the economy is Jim McTagg, Washington editor for Barron's. Jim, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
So we're trying to figure this out. I mean, maybe that's simply impossible, but we're going to give it the old college try here. And we've got numbers all over the place. Just at the beginning of this week, I remember waking up to news that the National Association for Business Economics said that, you know, we've got stuff coming up like roses all over the place. Manufacturing strong. Here's Lynn Reeser. She's the head of the group. This is a bunch of economists working for business. She said, although risks involving Europe have recently escalated, the outlook in this country has improved in most respects. Growth prospects are stronger. Unemployment and inflation are lower. Worries relating to consumer retrenchment and domestic financial headwinds have diminished. And then we got markets tumbling everywhere and people talking about, you know, falling into the abyss. What's going on, Jim?
It's crazy. I mean, one week I look at my 401k and I say, praise the Lord, I can retire at age 87.
Right.
And this week I have to work till
it's 187.
Yeah. So, right. You know, I personally am bullish. We are seeing improvement. Things are less bad. You know, and we knew we would get to this point where things were less bad. But there are a lot of headwinds that an improving economy has to overcome. For example, something like the BP oil spill, that will affect the oil drilling industry, which is part of the durable good orders. So actually, these durable good orders that came out this week is a mixed bag, because it reflects that orders may be slowing because of problems in Europe. I think 40% of our machinery is shipped to Europe, or overseas, and half of that goes to Europe.
But here, very recently, we saw Caterpillar and Whirlpool with strong results coming out. The Manufacturers Alliance, a trade group, sharp increase in its composite index on shipments and inventories and profit margins, said, you know, it was up to the highest level since June 2004. This is just a couple of weeks ago. And just this week, we had big-ticket manufactured goods rising 2.9%, orders, therefore. It sounds good.
You know, if the old saw about a bull market climbs a wall of worry, if that's accurate, we're probably at the beginning of a huge bull market. But, you know, personally, I think it will take until about the end of 2012 for the economy to fully recover. We still have about 8 million or 15 million people unemployed, actually. You know, we need 8 million new jobs to make people start to feel better. And that will take 2 or 3 years. So again, things are they're improving, but at a very slow rate. But hey, the economy's not dead. Hallelujah.
Well, will you say 2012, but these National Business Association economists are talking about a majority of them polled, and there's a lot of them, expecting the economy's performance to exceed the long-term norm in 2010 and 2011. That's right now.
I disagree, because there are too many unknowns. We're going to have a change in tax policy at the end of this year, you know, a big change. We're also have companies wrestling with the impact of health care. Yesterday, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which represents the little Main Street guy, joined in a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Obama health care plan, because they say that it will really burden small business and it will damper hiring. So, it's a mixed bag. I mean, for as many people who are bullish, people like me, you can find a whole room of pessimists.
Well, we see that in the markets. The Commerce Department numbers out today, though, they say the economy grew at 3% in the first quarter. Now, they had estimated 3.2%. I mean, 3% is not bad. It's not booming out of a recession, but, I mean, compared to last year, 3% sounds pretty good.
Well, because we're coming from negative numbers. Mm-hmm. Actually, 3% is lousy, because in previous recessions, you'd be growing at 6 or 7% coming off a bottom like that. Just look at all the young people in your own family who have just graduated from college and can't find jobs. It's pretty bad for a lot of people out there. It's better for people who have jobs, are feeling more secure. And consumer confidence was up last month. And I think that's because in the $787 billion stimulus plan, most of it, which to me didn't make sense, 35% or $275 billion went to tax cuts over 10 years. So people in April, they get their tax refunds and they begin to feel good. And, you look today, Costco, their earnings beat estimates. So I think the consumer is feeling better because of tax cuts. I think we're going to need more tax cuts going forward, so we don't go back into a recession.
Who knows which way that's headed? I'm reading here Christina Romer in Paris today. This is one of the president's top advisors on the economy, saying we may need more fiscal stimulus. To relieve state and local governments. A lot of people's measure, if they have two pennies to rub together and save, is that 401k you talked about. And there, the fear last week, this week, is that those markets could just take some kind of super dive. I mean, things just seem so weirdly unsettled between fear and hope.
Yes. Now, Barron's, of course, we write for investors. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is a golden opportunity. The investors who missed the big run-up in stocks that began in March 2009 and ended last week, they have another opportunity to get in at low prices. But you have to shop very carefully.
But is that how you're describing this, an opportunity rather than a bunch of volatility before a swoon?
Yeah, I think it's a golden opportunity for people who missed the big run-up last year in the stock market. We're going to have a rerun. It might not be as dramatic. You have to think long-term. But I think this is, one of those occasions when you can be a little contrarian and make some money here.
Boy, it takes nerves of steel to do it. Jim McTigg.
Yeah, it doesn't, because either the economy collapses and your money isn't worth anything, so you might as well roll the dice here.
Wow. What a picture of the world we're in. Jim McTagg, Washington editor at Barron's. Jim, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joining me now from College Park, Maryland, is Carmen Reinhart, professor of economics at the University of Maryland. She's co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. She testified yesterday before President Obama's Fiscal Commission on the vulnerability of the U.S. economy. Carmen Reinhart, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're going to hear in this hour as well from Alan Blinder, another big economist who not so long ago was talking a pretty optimistic line. You're talking a bit of a scarier line. What did you tell the president's commission yesterday?
The main thrust of my commentary was highlighting the risks, uncertainty, and volatility that usually go hand in hand with being highly leveraged. And both the private sector and the public sector in the United States are highly leveraged. In the private sector, households and financial firms are still swimming in record levels of debt. The non-financial sector is, of course, in much better shape. But when you take together the financial firms, the households, the central bank, and the government, that is a big chunk of the U.S. economy. And for years now, I literally have to say for years, because let us not forget, subprime began in the summer of 2007. Ken Rogoff and I, my co-author and I, have been stressing that financial crises, when they're these severe, are protracted affairs, that the economy doesn't have the usual recession. Just to put it in perspective, the usual recession for the United States post-World War II last less than a year. We've been in this muddle. We all, I think, are in agreement that the bottom, the despair of the fall of 2008 is behind us. But the recovery process, I think, is going to be subpar.
But how do you explain the enthusiasm of these National Association of Business Economists? They're saying they see a 2010 and a 2011 running ahead of the norm. They're using the bullish word here. And where does that come from if we're stuck in a problem?
I think there is a sense that the laws of gravity are going to be held up here. Namely, if you fall a lot, you'll bounce a lot. And that's what we saw in the 82 recession. The 82 recession was a very severe recession, the worst in the post-war up to that time.
You don't believe in the big bounce from the big fall?
And we got a big bounce in 82. Let me just say something why I don't think the big bounce of 82 is going to be replayed here. First of all, in 82, we had the highest levels of real interest rates since the 1930s. The Fed had a lot of room to go further.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. economy wavering between hope and fear, between evidence of recovery and fear of a double dip or long, long down. Europe's in trouble. Markets are down. Where are we going here? We've been talking with economist Carmen Reinhart, professor at the University of Maryland, author of This Time, co-author of This Time is Different. She joins us from College Park, Maryland. Right now from Princeton, New Jersey, we're joined as well, and very happy to be so, by Alan Blinder, professor of economics at Princeton, former vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. He was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. Alan Blinder, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure. Hello, Tom.
You, in December, were quite prominently optimistic, looking out on the economy in a big op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. We've got some water under the bridge since then. Where do you stand today? Are you still the optimist?
Well, I am. I think a little bit of the edge has come – of the optimism has come off because of the travails in Europe. We don't know where that's going yet. But I don't want to exaggerate that because most of what happens in the United States is made at home. We're not immune by any means, but we control our own destiny very substantially. So I guess I'm an optimist, but a little bit less of an optimist before Greece started blowing up.
Well, but people look at that and they talk about a contagion in Europe and, you know, Spain helps out a little bank yesterday and China gets a little tweaky on the euro and suddenly the U.S. markets are down again. I mean, the fear seems to be that these things could all jump the ocean and just really whack the USA.
No, that's exactly right. Well, whack is probably a little – well, in a worst case, it could whack the U.S. I mean, you could imagine returning to the financial fears, even panic of 2008 and early 2009. I don't think that will happen, but – You certainly can't rule it out as an impossible event. I think the more likely scenario is that what happens in Europe has enough adverse contagion here to shave a few tenths, maybe a half a percentage point off the U.S. growth rate, which is certainly not welcome because we're sort of just limping toward recovery here.
So, Carmen Reinhart, how about it? A few tenths or half a percentage off the growth rate? We know that's a big deal. But it's not calamity. Do you see that as the extent of the downside risk from the European situation?
I would say that's probably right because we can't forget. But I do stress that we have our homegrown debt problems, which I want to really emphasize. We can't forget that paradoxically, the life of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency has been lengthened by a crisis that began in the United States and now the European situation. The real serious contender to the dollar had been the euro. That's out of the picture for the time being. But that means that there's a greater appetite for U.S. treasuries than that might have been otherwise. That actually works to ease pressures in the interest rate front in the U.S. Rather than all negative. It's not all negative for the U.S. I would say, though, that we do have our own debt problems, notwithstanding of anything that is happening in Europe.
Well, what about that, Alan? You say our destiny is made at home, and Carmen might shake her head yes and say, well, but we're making a bad one. We've got all this debt problem to look at.
I think Carmen has it exactly right. We have a huge debt problem, but it's relatively far in the future compared to, say, Spain or Italy or Portugal, not to mention Greece. And this European crisis has ironically given us a little bit of a reprieve because the bond market vigilantes have all landed in Europe. And our treasury rates have actually gone down. Our bond prices have gone up. That's lowered mortgage rates. And that's giving a little bit more impetus to the U.S. Recovery, as is, by the way, the falling price of oil, which is helping all the oil-using economies. So there are those pluses offsetting the negatives. The big worry is what you asked about before, financial contagion. Once panic starts getting loose, you don't know where it's going to hit next, and you don't know the magnitude. It's a very precarious and starts relying more on mob psychology than economics.
You call it mob psychology, but we're reading today an op-ed page of the New York Times, David Einhorn, big hedge fund guy, very influential in kind of bringing down Lehman Brothers. And he's saying, you know, we've worried about passing debt on to future generations, but we don't need to worry about that because we're going to have to deal with it in this generation. The crisis is coming right into our face. You know, is that just mob psychology or is that justified nearly immediate fear?
Well, I don't think nearly immediate is the right term. If you know, I read that op-ed too, and he was pointing out that this is not our grandchildren's problem but our problem.
Right.
So depending who the average American is age around 42 or something like that. And this definitely has to be resolved within the lifetime of such people and probably within my lifetime, and I'm a good deal older than 42. So this is not a problem for our grandchildren. The point is that it's also not a problem – it doesn't appear to be a problem for the year 2010. And furthermore, the European crisis, as Carmen was mentioning, given us a little bit more breathing room actually. Breathing room maybe we don't deserve. We ought to be taking care of this better than we are. But at least as things look now, I don't see an imminent budgetary crisis in the United States.
Carmen, I mean, everybody's teetering as they watch the market. You know, stay in, get out, get in gold, get in the bunker, or believe the kind of juice that was on the streets very, very recently and go out shopping. Do you see the European contagion giving us a breather here, or do you see it breathing down our necks, kind of pushing us over the edge in a bad way?
In terms of prolonging the life of the dollar, it's giving us breathing space. However, we are in a cloud of uncertainty. And even if our debt numbers today, gross debt is very close to 90% now, gross government debt is, and that is the highest number we've had since World War II. The concerns are uncertainty about future tax liabilities, uncertainty about future benefits, uncertainty and long-term investment, uncertainty and long-term planning, and uncertainty and markets do not like each other. And I think to cloud this picture of uncertainty further is what is happening in Europe. Let us not forget that Europe and Japan and the U.S. are all in the largest debt situation in different degrees that we've had since World War II. And I think we don't have 10 years to take care of our debt situation because expectations, if one looks at any profile of U.S. government debt, and sees it rising beyond the 100%, beyond the 110% of GDP mark. Mm-hmm. It's very, very much a source of concern to markets now. even though that may not be raising a solvency issue now. And those are the projections that are on the table from the IMF, from the CBO, and so on.
From the White House, Well, I want to look at that with Alan. I mean, that sounds like pretty immediate, but let me get a caller here. We've got a lot who want to join you, Alan Blinder and Cameron Reinhardt. Pat in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm not a financial person at all. I happen to have a friend who's also vice president of a big financial company, and she's done very well with our money. I mean, our money is back almost to where it was before that last crash.
Lucky you.
As a matter of, pardon?
Lucky you, I say.
Yeah, well, I don't know, lucky, whatever. Just holding fast and trusting her, and we just sent her $5,000 more, and I am retired, although I still work full-time. So that's all just another little viewpoint.
Well, that's a great indicator. Let's pick that up. Alan, is Pat doing the right thing here? She's retired.
Whatever she's doing, well, she's retired, but she said she's working.
The new retirement, retired and working. But she's sending $5K into this very volatile, the word everybody loves, market.
Well, I don't know what the money is going for. It sounds like it's going for safe assets. I can tell you I wish my portfolio was back to where it was at the peak. It certainly isn't. So I think she's doing pretty well.
And a lot of people who got close may not be as close as they were 2 weeks ago. I mean, Carmen, what do you think? There's Pat, semi-retired, let's say, shipping her $5,000 back into the market. It looks like a buying opportunity. We heard the same thing from Jim McTagg at Barron's. Do you buy that, Carmen?
I think you have to have strong nerves. I hope she has strong nerves. I think volatility, I do not forecast the market, but I do think high periods of leverage are noted for their uncertainty and volatility. So I think whichever way we go, it's going to be a very rough ride.
Let's get a call from Niagara Falls, New York, and Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. This is like good news and bad news joke to me, because a strong dollar, doesn't it mean, at least I'm given to understand that it means that we won't be able to export our way out of it, so that we won't have manufacturing jobs to manufacture the stuff to export because we have a strong dollar.
Exactly. Alan, what about it? We've got these manufacturing numbers that are looking up in Caterpillar and Whirlpool, but you know, Mark points to the problem with the strong dollar, isn't it?
Mark's exactly right. I was saying before that there are a couple of pluses coming out of the European crisis, which is that oil is falling and our interest rates have gone down. But there are also minuses, some obvious minuses, and the strong dollar is one of them. I mean, it was never going to be the case that we were going to export our way out of this crisis, because the whole world, out of this recession, because the whole world more or less was in recession. But exports were expected to make some minor contribution. That's now in some doubt because of the dollar. In addition to that, as you were indicating a moment ago, the stock market has taken another fall. And by the way, some of the interest rate spreads, the interest rate differentials between risky securities and treasuries have also widened. And that's a negative. So you got pluses and minuses coming out of this. On balance, it's a minus, and that's where I was talking about a few tenths, maybe a half a point of growth lost. And one of the reasons is just what Mark said, the dollar.
But does that a few tenths or half a point, that's not good. But does that mean that essentially the U.S. economy is big enough unto itself that it can plow through Europe's crisis and still recover?
Yes, yes. It's still roughly the case. So exports and imports are very different from one another now, so let's not get into details. But it's still approximately the case that 7/8 of what Americans consume, buy, is made here, and 7/8 of what our industries manufacture is bought by Americans. The foreigners are the other 1/8, roughly. It's different for exports and imports, of course. So the answer to your question is yes, 7/8 of our destiny is made at home.
Chris, Carmen Reinhardt is really worried about the debt. Lots of people are. But then here we're reading, this is just AP out of Paris, and Christina Romer, head of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, is there today speaking to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. And she's saying to them that it would be a mistake for the U.S. to rapidly wind down fiscal stimulus measures to bring down the deficit. She's saying They may need further measures, fiscal relief for state and local governments, extension of emergency benefits for the long-term unemployed to add oxygen to the what she called nascent economic recovery. Do we have the money to do that, Alan?
We borrow it. So you come back to what you said before. We certainly don't have the money. That is, we're not paying for it out of current receipts. But, you know, the U.S. Treasury is now borrowing for 10 years at about 3.3%, for 2 years, I think, at about 0.75%. I haven't looked recently. For 3 months at almost zero, 10 basis points or something like that. So at least right now and for the near-term future, although as Carmen and others say, this is not going to last forever, we have the money in the sense that we can go to the capital markets and raise it easily, cheaply.
So, Carmen, if it's that cheap and maybe there's still some fear about whether this recovery is sustainable, maybe your debt concern is not the first concern we should have. Paul Krugman's still saying, you know, last week, we're going to turn ourselves into a decade-long swamp like Japan if we're not careful.
We are already closer to the Japanese scenario than we care to admit. But let me say something about the debt situation. It is one thing to talk about withdrawing stimulus prematurely. I have written on the issue that one of the big mistakes Japan made, one of the big mistakes we made during the Depression was precisely that, withdrawing stimulus too early. I think that's a real risk. That, however, does not preempt us from having a program that reduces the deficit and debt profile in the outer years, because that is very important for shaping expectations. So it doesn't mean run out and pull the plug and threaten the recovery now, but it does mean come up with a plan now that puts the debt and deficit on a sustainable path. They're not the same thing.
But those outer years you're talking about are not so far away. You're saying we don't have 10 years, you were saying, to take care of the debt problem. I mean, that's
but
not...
We're not having a 10-year recession either, hopefully. One can still provide the near-term stimulus and have us in a trajectory within a 5-year period, a trajectory that shows sharp improvement in debts and deficits. That is not undoable.
Alan Blinder, would you agree with Christina Romer? Maybe a little more stimulus gas here to help out state and local governments?
I do agree, and I agree with what Carmen just said. They're not at all inconsistent, as she was saying. Mm-hmm. As long as you have credibility, and this is the hard part, as long as you have credibility with the markets, spending a little more today to help us get out of this recession while promising credibly to reduce the deficit in the future is the ticket. It's the way to square the circle to get out of this box. Saying that is easier than doing it. And I think, and here I do agree with Carmen, that one of the ingredients, if this is to be pulled off, we're getting this breathing space now, but once the breathing space is gone, if this is to be pulled off, is to put in place a credible long-run plan to trim the deficit.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. economy wavering between hope and fear with economist Alan Blinder, former vice chairman of the Board of Governors for the Fed. He's at Princeton. Carmen Reinhart is with us from the University of Maryland, co-author of This Time is Different. She was testifying just yesterday before President Obama's fiscal commission about the vulnerability of the economy, looking at debt. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Reinhart keeps talking about debt, and we're all concerned about that, but I think that really the question that I haven't heard her address yet would be, how do we get rid of it? Where do we cut? Where do we raise money? Those are the two ways you get out of debt. The other thing I'd say is, isn't this volatility in the market just one more piece of evidence? Here's the elephant in the room. The stock market is almost got nothing to do with the economy. It's no longer a way to raise capital to run businesses. It's a gambling market. and the volatility is an indication of it being manipulated in the short term for what would have never been envisioned when it was formed as a method of raising capital.
Yeah, we've got it loud and clear, Jim. I'll take that up with Alan Blinder. But the first one on debt, Carmen, I mean, how do we get out? In the time frame that you're describing, with the debt of the scale that everybody sees on the table, $13 trillion or something now, how do we get out without killing any recovery?
Well, let me say two things. First is, let's talk about getting out of private debt first, which is a problem. It's a problem for households. It's a problem for banks.
Mm-hmm.
For households, it means that relying on the household sector to be the engine of growth, as they have been in the preceding recessions, is unlikely. A different word for foreclosure is default, and that's what we're seeing. We're getting out of debt the ugly way in households through default, but we're also going to get out of debt through spending curbs, that is, not having the big bounce back in consumer spending that we've gotten in other recoveries. That's households. For financial firms.
So that's austerity at home, right in the kitchen.
That's austerity at home.
Mm-hmm.
For financial firms, there is a lot of debt overhang. These are toxic loans that, because of forbearance, have not been written down. This is very Japanese.
There's talk ending that right now, about requiring mark-to-market.
I have been an advocate of that for the last couple of years as a way of, okay, let's shed all this bad debt and move on. That is a way of getting the write-downs are a way of getting the banks on a healthy footing to renew a more normal pattern of lending, which we haven't yet seen.
Ellen,
the government, nothing that I have to say is pleasant. On the spending side, I think we seriously have to contemplate things like value-added taxes. And those are there are all the kinds of sacred cows, like all the exemptions on home ownership. I think this is really going to come to a point where we have to put a lot of things that we take for granted, including us, other people can have value-added taxes, but not us, including mm-hmm. those kinds of very unpopular measures, if you will. I think everything has to be on the table. I think things like retirement age will also come up. I don't give out good news, but it is the way that it is known to work when you're closing a very sizable budget deficit.
Sounds like the American version of the Greek belt tightening. Alan, there's a lot on the table. First, on households as engines of growth in consumer spending, Carmen doesn't think they'll do it this time. Can the U.S. economy come back and stay back on the basis of business growth instead of consumer spending growth?
I think you can. First of all, you can for a period. The big push out of the bottom here came from business spending, mm-hmm. Inventories, equipment, software,
right.
Things like that. It's still going on. At some point, and we're about at that point, the baton needs to be passed to the consumer. But what that means is not that the consumer is spending more than he or she are earning, but only something like the savings rate being about constant so that consumption growth matches income growth. And that's roughly what we're looking at lately. It's actually – consumption's actually been growing a little stronger than income. But as long as the consumer does his and her bit by spending in proportion to income, the recovery – not an exuberant boom, but a reasonable recovery – can persist.
What about the threat of a Japan-style decade of deflation and stagnation?
I just don't think the U.S. political system will stand for that.
What does that mean? We can't vote that out,
means,
can we?
Well, we can in the sense that – I mean, look what our legislators did in February 2009. They voted a huge stimulus package that – exceeds $800 billion.
Japan spent oodles, though. They built bridges and roads all over the place and didn't get out of it.
They spent it ineffectively, and some of that was window dressing. They didn't spend as much as they said they were going to spend. And also, their central bank was very passive for a long time, compared to the Fed. We shouldn't leave the Fed out of this picture. So I just don't think the United States will stand for it. Indeed, we're not. I mean, we're growing at a nice rate right now. It'd be nicer if it was faster, but we're growing at a very nice rate.
Japan has had to eat a lot of deflation. What about that risk here, deflation versus the inflation risk, everybody?
Well, there is
about
a little risk of that. If you look at the recent, you know, it's ironic because every once in a while you pick up the newspaper and you hear somebody screaming about an inflation scare and we should all get into gold or something like that. In fact, you see
people
that every
day. People are doing it, yeah.
And some people are doing it. Well, if you actually look at the numbers on core inflation, it's very important to strip out the energy, which is largely driven by oil part because it's so volatile and can be misleading. The core rate of inflation has been going down, 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 down during this recession, which is what it always does during recessions. At last count, the 12-month CPI core inflation rate is just under 1% and falling. So I don't dismiss the possibility that we could get into some mild deflation, such as Japan. And so in that sense, it would be like Japan. But
is that death
I think
to
growth,
or can you deflate and grow?
You can deflate and grow as long as you're not having really high rates of let's put it this way. The larger the rate of deflation goes, the more hazard it is. Hazard, the more the hazard to growth because people start hoarding money, and that's not good. Look, I think it's a bad outcome. We don't want to get to that, and neither mm-hmm. I know that Chairman Bernanke at the Fed does not want to get to that.
But his rates are at zero already. He doesn't have a lot of gas left there.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's why he got down to zero to mm-hmm. try to avoid this. I think we've reduced the probability relative to, say, 18 months ago that we would wind up with negative inflation rates, but we certainly haven't reduced it to zero. It's a real possibility.
Carmen, I'm always curious. You know, here we are looking at the same table full of indicators, and you know, Alan looks at all that, and he's got a kind of an optimistic view out of it, even though he agrees with a lot of your analysis. You look at it, and you sound, you know, pretty gloomy and pretty darn worried. Is that just a matter of, I don't know, how you were brought up or whether you had sunshine?
Having a deep, dark, grim personality.
Well, does it boil down to economist personalities, how two economists look at this?
It probably does. But I would say that my views are very colored by problems of debt overhangs. Mm-hmm. And the terms lost decade hasn't been lost on me on the case of Japan, but also in, of course, a much more disastrous way in the case of Latin America. The lost decade for so many Latin countries also involved huge debt overhang. Japan's lost decade involved a debt overhang. I am deeply concerned about that issue. And let's not forget that like Japan, the dollar has been appreciating pretty much through the beginning of the crisis with some blips here and there, but the trend in the dollar hasn't helped. Most often when you have a severe financial crisis like this, the currency crashes. As ugly and painful as that may be while it's crashing, it actually helps revive the economy. It helps the recovery. It didn't help Japan, and it's not helping us. But you have to add my personality to that.
I guess
that.
We do. I mean, Alan, people are going to think about personalities, but it's their livelihoods and their savings on the table. They, in the end, they don't want a personality factor. They want guidance or some sense of, you know, whether we're crashing or pulling out.
Absolutely. We're pulling out. We're certainly pulling out. The question is the speed. Maybe the way to put these differences into perspective is to harken back to the tremendous recovery we had after the last mega recession in 1982. Carmen mentioned that mm-hmm. earlier. An unknown fact is, well, you can just look it up, but people don't look, is that for the 6 quarters after the bottom of that recession, the U.S. averaged between 7 and 7.5% growth. I'm going to say that again, between 7 and 7.5.
But now we're at
that's
3.
That's a boom. Right, but that's what I'm saying. My optimistic scenario is growth around 3.5%. That makes me an optimist these days. Compared to what we did in the 1980s, that's not a good outturn at all.
Wow. Okay, the slide rule just moved. But at least that's not another downturn, and maybe that's the best we can hope for right now. Maybe that is recovery today. It's been great having the two of you. I mean, people are really thinking a lot about this, and we're very grateful to you for weighing in. Alan Blinder at Princeton, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And Carmen Reinhart at the University of Maryland, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, husband and wife Nicholas Kristof and author Cheryl Wu Dunn share advice for 2010 grads. This is On Point. Last Sunday, husband and wife New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and author Cheryl Wu Dunn delivered the commencement address to graduates of Middlebury College in Vermont. In 1990, they won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of China's Tiananmen Square uproar, the first married couple to win the Pulitzer for journalism. They told graduates in Vermont not to worry about helping solve all the world's problems, but to help out one individual at a time. Helping the individual, Wu Dunn said, is a legitimate way of changing the world and can also change you for the better.
There's been a great deal of research over the last 20 years into what makes us happy. Research in neurology, in social psychology, in economics. And the lessons are complex. But one of the answers is that after you have fulfilled all of your material needs, which all of us here in this on this quad have, one of the few ways to actually elevate your level of happiness, to actually raise the set point that we all have for happiness, one of the few ways is to contribute to a cause larger than ourselves. Another way of putting it is this. Our efforts to give back by helping others, frankly, have a somewhat mixed record of success. But they have an almost perfect record of helping ourselves.
There'll be some skeptics who will ask, why should I care? One answer to that is that if you've seen, if you've looked into the eyes of a bright, ambitious girl who wants to go on to school but can't for want of $20 in school fees, then you don't ask that question. Another is when you see a kid dying of malaria for want of a $10 bed net, you don't ask that question.
That's one reason we want you to take a bit of risk, to get out of your comfort zone. Whether in America or abroad. The experience will change you. It will give you the drive to help others and to feel better about it too. Another answer is that the experience will give you a new and broader perspective on life. Middlebury has already given you some foundation. We are sure, we know that. But efforts to give back will build on that experience, by helping you see your own life in a new light.
We want to leave you with a story of a friend of ours, a young American woman who was working in Sudan. I met her in Darfur, where she saw things that no human being should ever have to see. She was unbelievably tough there. She never flinched. She did what she had to do. Never broke down. And then she came back here over Christmas vacation. She's in her grandmother's backyard. And she loses it. She's sobbing and crying. She's completely broken down. You know what it was?
It was a bird feeder. Her grandmother had put out a bird feeder. And our friend, who had just come from a land where they throw babies into bonfires because of the color of their skin or the tribe they come from. And she realized that she had the great fortune to be born in a land where we take security for granted, where we have the wealth not only to feed, clothe, and house ourselves, but also to provide for wild birds in the winter. She saw her life in a whole new perspective, and she realized that with that great fortune comes great responsibility as well.
The truth is that all of us here have won the lottery of life. The fact that you are graduating from a great college in America means you've won the global jackpot. And when you do, then the question becomes, in the coming days, months, and years, how you go about discharging the responsibility that comes with that. The question is what you will give back and how.
So congratulations, graduates. In parting, we hope that you will go out and take some risks and give back. And in the process, you will gain perspective. You will be happier. And we've no doubt you will change the world. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Husband and wife, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and author Cheryl Wu Dunn, addressing graduates at Middlebury College in Vermont on Sunday. To see a video of the speech and to link to all the commencement addresses we've aired this graduation season, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.